Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk about China first and foremost, as we often do on this program, because it is first and foremost when it comes to enemies, foreign, well, and arguably domestic as well. Certainly, it's friends in our country that has enabled much of the unrestricted warfare that the Chinese Communist Party has been waging and is continuing to wage against us, even as it appears to be preparing for, well, the old-fashioned kind of war, the shooting kind. And who better to talk to about all of that than our friend and comrade in arms, Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man whose service to our country includes that of a foreign service officer, as well as an attaché in the U.S. Embassy, as well as a businessman forward deployed in East Asia for quite some time. He is, in addition to all of that, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and the author of a terrific new book, When China Attacks, A Warning to America. Colonel Newsom, it's good to have you back. Welcome once again, sir.
Well, thanks very much. Glad to be here.
I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things that you've been raising an alarm about. One is that the Chinese seem very set on and making some strides towards driving the United States out of the Western Pacific in furtherance of their efforts to, acquire, shall we say, Taiwan one way or another, perhaps through a blockade, if not through actual physical attack. Talk us through how you see what's happening there at the moment, and it doesn't sound good for American interests.
Well, it doesn't sound good. The Chinese have, over the last decade plus, have built up a military that in certain circumstances could give the Americans all they could handle and probably a whole lot more. The Chinese have had de facto control of the South China Sea for about 4 or 5 years now, and even senior American officers have admitted this. What has happened is the military buildup has created an overmatch in the area right around Taiwan, just off of the Chinese coast, to the point that American forces would only go in there with great trepidation, and they just might not come out. If they do, that's how bad it's gotten. And this is part of China's strategy, and what they are doing, you're watching them do it, and if you've paid attention for a while, you've seen this happening. They have built up the military capability to at least think they would have a pretty good shot at launching a full-scale assault on Taiwan and taking the place. Of course, this takes place with a lot of political warfare, subversion, and just threatening of Taiwan. They'd like to get it without fighting, of course. But they are indeed willing to do either if they feel like they have to. And how could this play out? Either just a massive assault, or it could be, as you've mentioned, possibly just a temporary blockade that they put in place and tell the Americans, stand clear. This is a domestic matter. If you get in, it's nuclear war. So there's different ways this could play out. None of them are good, and both of them would prevent, or at least all of them, would prevent an American administration with some very difficult choices. And if you haven't made the necessary preparations to get ready, you may not be able to make those choices other than to let Taiwan go.
A perennial question put to people like yourself, sir, with deep knowledge of the region, is when might all this eventuate? There are some who are arguing that there likely will be sort of a third set of exercises to demonstrate basically all of the capabilities needed to invade the island, possibly sometime in August. There are others who say, no, they're probably going to wait, since they would like to take the place without fighting if they can, until after the presidential elections in Taiwan set for, I believe, January. Where do you come down? Either those or some other scenario?
Well, I might go with the wait and see what happens in the Taiwan presidential election. That would be my guess. So after January 2024, we'll see if a pro-China candidate wins, or a guy who's willing to accommodate China or deal with China, he wins. The Chinese might back off and expect him to hand over Taiwan eventually. But if the other guys can't, if the other guy wins, I would expect some shooting at that point. A lot will depend on what is going on in the United States, because China does very carefully assess the state of affairs in the U.S. And if we're too confused to much at each other's throats, then they may see that as a reason to take their chances on Taiwan. But one should not underestimate what Xi Jinping and the Chinese regime. And keep in mind, this all started long before Xi Jinping showed up. He's not the problem. The problem is the nature of the Chinese regime. But I would not underestimate their intentions. They've been very clear. That is to get the United States out of Asia, out of the Pacific, and to ultimately dominate the region and beyond.
Yeah, that's the goal for sure. You had a piece recently about Okinawa, and you made the very, I think, astute observation that after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing over many years in which the Japanese people, to some extent, the Japanese government has been essentially hoping that the United States military would pack it in and leave. They seem to be rather happy that we're there at the moment. Talk a little bit about why and how important Okinawa is to the kind of scenarios that you were discussing just a moment ago.
Yeah, well, the Japanese government is probably glad it didn't get its way and get the Americans out of Okinawa. The real reason is that Japan knows that it cannot defend itself from China on its own. It has to have the Americans on their side and the Americans present. And Okinawa is as important as it's ever been. And it's the reason a real estate agent will tell you that the most important thing is location, location, location. It's a chain. It's Okinawa Island is one part of a chain of islands called the Ryukyus, extending from southernmost Japan almost all the way to Taiwan. It's effectively a barrier to Chinese forces, even if they go after Taiwan. From that chain of islands, the Ryukyus, you can threaten and cause all sorts of damage to a Chinese invasion force going after Taiwan. So it allows you to conduct offensive operations, but also it has a defensive a role as well. And this is why the Chinese are very interested in that chain of islands and have pretty much said that, you know, then they used to belong to China. One day we'll get them. But Okinawa is, as I said, as important as it's ever been. But at the same time, the Chinese rocket force knows exactly where it is, where the targets are, and they could hammer them if they want. So it's important, and the Americans have started to do this, is to look at the whole map and set themselves up in as many places as possible in the Pacific. Give themselves some strategic depth, not just put all your eggs into the Okinawa basket. So from an American perspective, these are key geography, strategic geography to the Japanese. They're equally important, but for the same reason. The Japanese military, of course, is limited in what it can do, and it can't operate as far afield as the Americans can. But the Japanese government must be thanking their lucky stars that the Americans didn't pack it in. And I will say this, and it's important to remember some of the history, that for 20 plus years, the Americans and the Japanese focused on the question of real estate on Okinawa. And that was the focus of it all. It wasn't on getting the Japanese to be a more useful military, either to themselves or to us, but rather top leadership, civilian and military on both sides, were fussing over this question of a few Marines on Okinawa. And so that was an absolute waste of time. It was unfortunate. Instead of doing something more useful, our best and brightest were sort of chasing this shiny object that ultimately served no purpose.
And we are the worse for lack of preparation that might otherwise have been taken in the meantime. Colonel Newsom, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with more with Colonel Grant Newsom, the author of When China Attacks, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Biden administration has been implicated in funding and otherwise encouraging an actual insurgency in Israel. That means it's been involved with opposition leaders, including former senior officials, directly working to overthrow Benjamin Netanyahu's elected governing coalition. There would never be a good time for Team Biden to be encouraging the destabilization of an allied democratic government, but this is a particularly dangerous moment to be distracting and undermining the Israelis. After all, they can no longer postpone the day of reckoning now confronting the Jewish state as a direct result of the cumulative effects of the appeasement, enriching, and emboldening of the Iranian regime over the Obama-Biden presidency's three terms that have incalculably helped the mullahs acquire nuclear weapons. Heaven help Israel and us if Bibi is unable to prevent the Ayatollahs from using the bomb they now surely have. This is Frank Affney. We're back. We are visiting with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a distinguished military officer, a man who has also distinguished himself in civilian life as well, not least as a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, of which we're very proud. Also a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, to which he contributes tremendously, notably in many of the webinars that we have featured in our book, The Indictment. And we're very grateful for that as well. Colonel Newsom, speaking of real estate and location, 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 the United States is now scrambling, I think it's fair to say, to try to contend with an effort that the Chinese have been making to attain some pretty important real estate in the Central Pacific, Palau, the Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. Give us a sense of what's going on there and what the stakes are.
Well, what you've got is the middle of the Pacific. And I encourage all the listeners to actually get out a map of the Pacific to see where this area is. And I would encourage all military people to do the same thing. For too many years, the top leadership and basically our forces in the Pacific were only interested in the western edge, from Korea to Japan to Taiwan to the Philippines, not to the middle of the map. But there are countries in the middle of the map, and particularly the three states, Palau, Federated States of Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands, along with Guam and the Northern Marianas, Saipan. And this is literally the middle of the Pacific. And it's where the bloodiest battles of World War II were fought to drive the Japanese out, so that we could get to Japan. And they are as strategic as they've ever been, but they've been ignored for so many years. That's, in fact, where the expression benign neglect came from. And that is a civilian failing as well, not just the military.
They've been ignored by us, I think you mean to say.
Oh, that's right. Oh, on the U.S. side, we just completely ignore them. The Chinese understand the value of them very well. They want them, and they have been setting up businesses there. They've been establishing political influence throughout, and in every one of these countries, they're one election away from shifting towards the PRC, away from America. And there's three negotiations that are underway, they're at various stages of completion, and that is to renew the agreements that America has with these three countries in the middle of the map, effectively in the rear area of our forward defenses, so that they will continue an arrangement they have that in exchange for some financial and other support, we are allowed free access to their territory, which is altogether it's the size of the United States, and we are allowed to prevent foreign militaries from going in. That is invaluable to have this ability to operate freely and to keep our enemies out of this strategic terrain. And the parts of the U.S. government are hemming and hawing over this, thinking it's too expensive, when the cost of it is about maybe a fraction of what they might have paid an Afghan drug dealer during the Afghan war. It's just absolutely nothing.
Yeah, chump change.
Yeah, but this is something that's going on. It's not getting the attention it deserves, but depending on the outcome of this, our position in the Pacific is going to be either strengthened or weakened.
China wants it,
we want to protect it.
Yeah, and we best do so. That's especially true, Colonel, in light of a very troubling report issued by the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, a highly regarded think tank down under, in which they described the United States as having essentially lost the lead in some 37, I believe, out of 44 key technology areas, many of them with direct relevance to military capabilities and preeminence. I wanted to ask you if, sir, quality, if I can use that expression, that we have relied upon for decades to offset our quantitative disadvantages is now more or less a thing of the past, that so-called qualitative edge. Your thoughts?
Well, it's certainly been reduced. And as you stated correctly, we just assumed for many years that we would always be at least several generations ahead of anybody when it comes to weaponry and our ability to make things and to innovate. But unfortunately, the Chinese are just as smart as us. In some respects, they're harder working. And they've been very clear on their objectives. Well, we have not, or we've had different objectives. That report from ASPE, the Australian group, these things are almost just scary to read because they're very well written, they're accurate. And, you know, what do you say? You know, it is something that if we don't wake up fast, and it's not something that can be postponed for much longer, that if we don't get this right, we could find ourselves on the short end. End of all of this, and a couple of just obvious examples of what we're talking about. You know, when some of the chemicals that you need to make explosives come from China, well, what could be the problem with that? Or magnets that go into our F-35s, well, they're only sourced from the PRC. Begging your pardon, but how did this happen? And, you know, this is just two of the 37, or however many it is. The Chinese have caught up. And in some cases, they have surpassed us.
Well, what you've just described, sir, is vastly worse than just having lost advantages. You're talking about strategic dependencies for not just our commercial economy and prosperity, but for our national security, our frontline capabilities in some cases. You asked the question rhetorically, how did we get to this pass? I would ask you, I think it has something to do with this phenomenon we describe at length in the indictment, namely the help the Chinese Communist Party has been getting from its friends in the United States who have seen no problem with shifting to these kinds of supply chain dependencies, no problem with allowing China to steal our advanced technology, in some cases our military secrets themselves. Is that how you see it? And if so, what do we do about it?
Well, it was either that or leprechauns did it. And it probably wasn't leprechauns. Yes, that's exactly what happened. And, you know, it's people that got us into this. And the most obvious example of it is our business class and Wall Street that have helped the Chinese build up their economy and their military. They provided the financial wherewithal that China needs to build up its military, but also the technology that's been delivered to China, willingly or unwillingly or unknowingly. But this is dual-use technology, and the Chinese have put it to good use. So that's our best and brightest have done this, and you know, successive administrations until the Trump administration. Unfortunately, our foreign policy elite, their policy was don't provoke China. Don't treat them like an enemy, because then you'll be sure to make them one. And that was the stated policy. And what we did is we treated the Chinese like a friend, and we got an enemy nonetheless. So how do you get around that? What do you do about this? Well, it's going to be tough, and I hope it doesn't require dead Americans to wake America up. But you know, hopefully our business and financial classes... Well, not, you know, I have some doubt that they would actually consider patriotism to be the issue in too many cases. But they might discover that, well, their business interests in China are actually at the whim of Xi Jinping. They might finally realize that doing business in a rapacious dictatorship, where a contract only means what the dictator says it is, that this is not prudent financial and business stewardship. If they realize that and think that, you know, we might get in trouble, sued by our shareholders for everything we have. Now, that might have some effect. I like to think it would, but I wonder. That would be helpful. I think Congress is kind of waking up, and just enough of it would tell the donor class, look, we're not going to take your money. We've got bigger problems just protecting the United States. That would be helpful. There are a lot of good people on Capitol Hill.
We need to be hearing from them, and they need to be engaging directly with these donors, because otherwise, I think the Chinese are right. They can count on Wall Street to essentially manipulate and run the Capitol Hill. We have to leave it at that, Colonel. We'll be back to you with more in the very near future. Thank you in the meantime, sir, and God bless you for all your great work. Keep it up. Talk to you soon.
Thanks very much.
Be right back with more right after this.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Dr. Andrew Bostom. I've known Andy for many years in a couple of different capacities, as it happens. He's a trained epidemiologist, now a retired professor and physician at Brown University. He has been deeply involved in the study of Sharia supremacism, my term, but it's very much relevant to his study of particularly jihad and the weaponization of it against, among others, Jews as a prime target of the intolerance of those who adhere to the traditions of Sharia. He is also a man who has spent a lot of time working on the COVID challenge, the virus itself, and what needs to be done about it, and what we've done instead. And we're going to try to talk with him about all of that and more. Dr. Andrew Bostom, it's great to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Really nice to be with you again, Frank.
Let's start with an issue that caught my attention thanks to your raising an alarm about it. Anti-Semitism is something you've devoted an enormous amount of your life to writing about brilliantly and extensively. There is a woman at the moment, we talked earlier in the week with Carolyn Glick about Deborah Lipstadt, who is these days the Biden administration's special envoy for monitoring and combating anti-Semitism. She had a rollout of anti-Semitism strategy at the White House recently and had some very unlikely people there as partners in this effort. Tell us about the episode and what your takeaway was from it. What should be ours?
What jumped out at me, without really getting involved in reading whatever the white paper on her project or her conception of how anti-Semitism should be combated, was a story in Jerusalem Post, which announced where she was reaching out apparently to the Council on American Islamic Relations, which is, you know, as Frank, your group has done yeoman work on this, Steve Emerson for many years, Robert Spencer. It's literally an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, proudly so, I think. It's open love affair with another branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Hamas. I just, you know, to partner with this organization as opposed to use it as an example for the unfortunate virulence of anti-Semitism in the Middle East and in the Muslim diaspora communities, those that abide its dictates, was just shocking to me. That CARE is unabashed in its has a long track record of really brazen anti-Semitism. Including inculcating anti-Semitism in children. There was a couple of infamous videos. Remember that Philadelphia mosque just several years ago? And they're unapologetic about their anti-Semitism. I just didn't, you know, they're Frank, you know me. I have been quite skeptical about often reformist movements in Islam. But, you know, if you're going to partner at all, those are the movements to partner with, not an open sort of branch of the Muslim Brotherhood.
And Andy, you know, what was striking to me was the Jerusalem Post story featured a quote from the White House document announcing this strategy and described the Brotherhood's, CARE, the Brotherhood doing business,
as
the Council on American Islamic Relations, that is, promising to launch a tour in which they would help various religious institutions secure their facilities, presumably in a manner akin to the way they have been securing mosques. And when we had John Guandolo on the show recently, he talked about them basically being fortified arsenals that are now being made more heavily fortified, thanks to government assistance and underwriting, but also that they were going to be working on building strong relationships among various faith communities. And again, you've studied these guys closely. What does the interfaith dialogue business actually entail as far as those like?
Well, I can remember a discussion you and I had once, and where we were discussing Sayyid Qutb, who was a 20th century ideologue, really a brilliant scholar in his own right, but again, an openly avowed jihadist, wrote a hideous tract where he sort of put together the most anti-Semitic motifs from the Quran and the traditions, etc., and explain them, you know, to Muslims, and brought in some modern themes of anti-Semitism, melded them together. But he described dialogue as, you know, sort of a bridge across a chasm, and the goal of the Muslim participants is to simply drag the non-Muslims across that chasm, or presumably just let them fall into it, you know, and perish if they don't want to be dragged across. It's just another form of Islamization, is the way I would describe it. Simply is
submission at the end of
submission,
the day, isn't
submission,
it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I was going to say dealing with the non-Muslim groups, whether they're Jews or other groups. In the Islamic tradition of the dhimmi, of those that, if you don't want to join our team, you know, then you're going to have to behave in a very submissive way and practice your faith in a way that we don't care if it's anathema to you, it's acceptable to us. You know, so
sort of closeted
dialogue.
At best. Yeah. That chasm thing, you know, for the purposes of bringing them to Islam
Exactly. That would be the long way to bring them to Islam, because, you know, the chronic grinding oppression of being a dhimmi might convince you to convert and not be
quickly
subjected to these restrictions.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the larger context of all of this, Andy, and that is that the Biden administration has been beholden to the Muslim Brotherhood, going back to the campaign when the president promised in exchange for their support that he would put their representatives in senior positions throughout his government, and they have done so. And this is evident, I think, too, in this event at the White House involving this anti-Semitism project. Carolyn Glick mentioned something, and I wondered if you had picked up on it as well, namely that one of the things that had been formally embraced internationally, but also by the United States government previously, was the idea that if you engage in anti-Zionism, that's the same thing as anti-Semitism. Right. And the Biden administration has apparently rescinded that. Is that your understanding?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it sounded like. Again, I'm coming at this, frankly, a little bit superficially, because I'm just going on the basis of the Jerusalem Post piece that I shared with you, and that was certainly implied in that piece, and that was also quite shocking to me. It wasn't quite as shocking as embracing care, but it would be part and parcel of the same thing, because after all, it is a longstanding trope, going back even before the Muslim Brotherhood existed, that there were to be distinctions made between, you know, Zionist Jews and Jews that were living in the Middle East, before the Zionist movement, who were willing to submit as dhimmi. That's an old trope. But anti-Zionism, over the years has now been accepted as just another form of anti-Semitism, and to reverse track on that is very disturbing.
Yeah, but it also fits a larger pattern, I think it's fair to say.
Absolutely, and in terms of Deborah Lipstadt, I just very briefly, I want to refer to. I have a colleague who was a medical student with me, as a matter of fact, who became a rabbi, and he's also a gastroenterologist, and he's been involved in interfaith dialogue. He's a big believer in interfaith dialogue. And he was at a session where Lipstadt was present, along with Ilan Carr, the former anti-Semitism envoy during the Trump administration. And he simply was citing data which I provided to him about this scourge of anti-Semitism across the Muslim world and in the Muslim diaspora communities in Europe and the United States, just disproportionate rates, ADL data, just raw ADL data. Deborah Lipstadt interrupted him in the middle of his question, which was framed around these data, and said, "What's the relevance of that?" And he continued and asked, and Ilan Carr, he was asking actually Ilan Carr. She was very rude, interrupting everybody.
President Trump's
yes, boy. And Carr was very, in this particular instance, Carr was very forthcoming about how, virtually all the violent attacks, certainly in Europe, which he had just come back from, were being unfortunately perpetrated by Muslims, that there was no other equivalent to that. So that stuck in my head when I saw this Jerusalem Post article that this woman is serious about her negationism. She really is.
Well, unfortunately, there's a phenomenon, as you know, Andy, better than anybody, of self-hatred among yes. Jews. And I think she may be an example of it. And
or dimitude.
Dimitude. A poor choice of somebody to be combating anti-Semitism, that's for sure, which is, absolutely, as you've said, and Carolyn did as well, is on the rise, not just overseas, but here as well. And the thing that is so troubling to me is, in addition to all of that, the Muslim Brotherhood has made no secret of their intention to destroy America.
Right.
Not just Jews, not just Israel, States itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Destroying our miserable house by our
from
own
within.
Hand, I think. From within, right. Exactly right. Andy Boston, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to start a further discussion of this topic with you in the prism of Iran, what it's up to, what it's likely to do to Israel unless stopped, and perhaps to us as well. That and more with Dr. Andrew Boston right after this. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Biden administration has been implicated in funding and otherwise encouraging an actual insurgency in Israel. That means it's been involved with opposition leaders, including former senior officials directly working to overthrow Benjamin Netanyahu's elected governing coalition. There would never be a good time for Team Biden to be encouraging the destabilization of an allied democratic government, but this is a particularly dangerous moment to be distracting and undermining the Israelis. After all, they can no longer postpone the day of reckoning now confronting the Jewish state as a direct result of the cumulative effects of the appeasement, enriching, and emboldening of the Iranian regime over the Obama-Biden presidency's three terms that have incalculably helped the mullahs acquire nuclear weapons. Heaven help Israel and us if Bibi is unable to prevent the Ayatollahs from using the bomb they now surely have. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and we're visiting with Dr. Andrew Bostom. He is the author, among other things, of Iran's Final Solution for Israel, The Legacy of Jihad and Shiite Islamic Jew Hatred of Iran, in Iran. Andrew Bostom, I wanted to talk with you on a theory of mine. In our conversation with Carolyn Glick, we talked about one other aspect of all of this, which is that there's a tremendous amount of ferment taking place inside Israel at the moment, as you know. The left there is seeking explicitly the overthrow of Benjamin Netanyahu's government, ostensibly over this judicial reform initiative, but it seems more generally because they think they can. And it appears that they are being actively supported by the Biden administration in these pursuits, destabilizing a sovereign allied democracy and doing so, to my point, at a very dangerous time. You've studied Iran closely. You know better than just about anybody how assiduously and patiently they've been pursuing the ultimate weapon of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, and how they've made no bones about it. They intend to use such weapons to get the little Satan and the big Satan dispatched. That would be Israel and the United States, of course, respectively. Talk us through what you think is happening at the moment, both in Iran, the danger it represents to Israel, and whether we could be seeing the Biden administration trying to hamstring Israel at a moment when it might need to defend those red lines it's drawn against a nuclear weapon in Iran's hands.
As Yogi Berra would say, it's like deja vu all over again. This is replaying exactly the same dynamics that we saw during the first Biden administration, or the Obama Biden administration.
We're in the third Obama Biden administration.
Yeah, the Obama Biden administration. Yeah. It's just eerily similar. It's the same tactics, and it's the same very dangerous game to give quarter to the worst forces in Iran. I mean, you know, Iran has an opposition movement again. I've never been overly optimistic about its chances of replacing this longstanding regime, which, you know, really came into power somewhat popularly. But it's certainly the people have soured. There's no question about that. And the numbers who have soured are growing with each generation.
Across the population.
And now the people, the ones that are really, you know, want to change the regime, are not willing to go for these half measures. You know, the going from to Ayatollah Montazeri, who's no longer with us, but that type. They want a secular regime, or they want a radical change. They would even prefer going back to a Shah-like period. Just to get rid of this theocracy. They're opposed to theocracy. And unfortunately in Iran, you know, the theocracy has always been very, very aggressive when they could be. And they were often hemmed in by various both non-Muslim and Muslim opposition, the Ottoman Empire for a period of time. But they've always had aspirations to lead the Muslim world and create the caliphate in their Shiite image, which is exactly what this revivalist movement is. And now, you know, if you give them nuclear weapons, I mean, Frank, some of the rhetoric does seem overblown when you hear, you know, the Revolutionary Guard, when you hear Khomeini and Khamenei. But on the other hand, they make all these efforts to build nuclear facilities and bury them deep beneath the ground. You have to take them seriously. And they have these apocalyptic beliefs at times that wax and wane. That just make them a very dangerous regime. And now we're seeing a recreation of this axis with, you know, with the communist world, which has also waxed and waned at various periods, but now it's strengthened again, given the horrible, you know, weakness and fecklessness of the Biden administration and the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. It's really brought these rather unreasonable and aggressive forces in Iran to thinking that, well, you know, maybe the opportunity is ripe.
The humiliation of the United States, yes, that has been the sort of leitmotif of this administration under Joe Biden, the most egregious example of it is, as you say, the Afghan retreat. But yeah. I think what we've put up with in this effort as supplicants to get the Iranians just to talk with us, let alone to make some sort of new deal, is one of the most ignominious things that I think has ever been inflicted on our country. And that's saying something, because as you indicated, Andy, in the Obama-Biden administration's first term, they went to great lengths to do the same.
It's worse now.
Joint comprehensive plan of action.
Yeah, it's worse now because I think the election of Biden was so incompetent and however it was pulled off has really whetted their appetite for going whole hog on these really self-destructive we consider them self-destructive. They consider them just the just measure that we deserve and ratcheting us down and again, the Afghan withdrawal was one of the worst humiliations of our military ever.
But this appeasement of Iran that has been evident in the conduct of this administration, especially, can only embolden the regime and make it more confident, especially now that it has this new axis, as you call it, with the Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
That they can act with, if not impunity, then certainly acceptable costs. But in their case, Andy, as you've documented so importantly in your books, if their ultimate objective is to bring back the 12th Imam through a process that looks an awful lot like the apocalypse, the worse the better, in a way, if the costs are very high indeed. Short break. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Andrew Boston, the author of, among other books, an important one about Iran's efforts to act on their Jew hatred in a way that is toxic in the extreme. Andy, we'll be right back with more. And when we come back, I do want to ask you a bit about this pandemic that you've been worrying and working on for so hard, for so long. Be right back with more right after this. We're back. Dr. Andrew Boston is in the house with us for one more segment, I'm very pleased to say, to talk a bit about some of his experiences and insights as a trained epidemiologist in what happened to us as a result of what I think now is increasingly, indisputably, a biological warfare attack by the Chinese Communist Party involving a virus they manufactured and genetically modified in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Dr. Bostrom, you were intimately involved in the understanding of this virus. Does that track with your assessment, sir?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on the origins of the virus, although, you know, I've tried to keep up with the literature, and the most plausible explanation does seem, you know, from the Wuhan Institute. When it got out and how it got out, it could have gotten out a lot earlier. Now we're going back, and there might have been cases, in much earlier in 2019. But at any rate, my focus really has been on the response here in Rhode Island. But it is a microcosm. And Frank, the first thing that I noticed, because let's just the 50,000 foot view is that, you know, thank God, whatever the origins are, this turned out to be very much like a flu virus, and its impact was really focused, very focused, thank God, on the frail, a broad-based way to say it, particularly the institutionalized elderly. And so we went from a disease that was, you know, whatever the Chinese intended, was very focused to an excuse to engage in practices that had been rejected in terms of epidemic responses by the great eminences of infectious disease epidemiology, including D.A. Henderson, who eradicated smallpox, spearheaded the drive, and was the dean of the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. Everything that we did in terms of lockdowns, mask mandates, vaccine mandates, quarantining the well, was anathema to Henderson. And we just did it anyway. So we reversed the normal paradigm. What was disparaged, the Great Barrington Declaration, which I'm sure you've heard about, was just traditional epidemiology. And we turned everything on its head. And one of the things that struck
me... destroyed. Doctors.
Oh, and destroyed socioeconomic effects were devastating and ushered in the Biden administration effectively. But one of the things that clued me into what was going on were the original models in my state. Frank, very quickly, on C-SPAN, in a national presser, it was covered live from Rhode Island. Then Governor Raimondo, who's now the Secretary of Commerce, announced that these models had been concocted by Brown University and the Rhode Island Department of Health. And they said, this was April 16, 2020, they said within 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, there was a more severe model and a less severe model. If the restrictions were in place, we were supposed to have 2,250 patients in Rhode Island hospitalized as a result of COVID, or the worst scenario was 4,300. Frank, we only have a little over 2,000 beds in Rhode Island, in the entire state. So she was saying every bed was going to be occupied with a COVID patient. And in the worst scenario, we'd have to have double that capacity of patients via field hospitals. 2.5 weeks. We peaked at about 350. They were never taken to task for these models. And I've been fighting the battle with lawyers, et cetera, about the mask mandates, about what was done to children. There are cases in litigation, mostly we lose, but it's been a real eye-opening experience for me, Frank.
Talk about one other piece of this, which you touched on in passing, but requires your skilled eye, Andy, and that is the vaccines. What we have learned about the vaccines and the damage they have done seems to have, vastly exceeded the dangers associated with the disease itself, were they not?
Yeah, and one of the things I discovered, Frank, is the leeway that are given to vaccines in terms of how they're brought to market. They are not subjected to the kinds of randomized controlled trials, even though there's plenty of problems with drug trials. You have to show prevention of clinical outcomes, hospitalization, death due to a specific disease, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, etc. That's not true of vaccines. The last time we did a vaccine trial that was large enough and well-designed enough to show a reduction in clinical outcomes, believe it or not, Frank, was the 1954 polio vaccine trial. That trial enrolled almost 2 million kids, and it showed it prevented about almost 400 cases of crippling polio. We haven't had come close to anything like that. By the way, that trial was run mostly by the state infantile paralysis societies. It wasn't this mega government or pharma trial. And it was fraught with difficulties too. There was a contaminated batch which severely injured children, et cetera. But we worked our way through it, and we came up with a salvageable, decent vaccine. We are light years from that now with vaccine trials.
And Andy, just to put a fine point on this, as I understand it, in some cases these tests didn't involve human experimentation at all. They were subset of rats, for God's sake.
What you're referring to is that, yeah, the initial data that were available, certainly, you know, to the public on the bivalent booster. So when they made a booster vaccine, because, you know, the virus had evolved, it was basically all Omicron. And even by the time they came out with the so-called bivalent vaccine, it had moved on again. But at any rate, yeah, the initial tests were in 10 mice. By the way, they all got infected. and that was the other thing, Frank. The vaccines, and this is the history of respiratory virus vaccines, attempts to immunize against influenza, COVID, previous version SARS-CoV-1, respiratory syncytial virus, they've never been able to confer anything close to a sterilizing immunity. So the idea that you were going to punish people for not taking the vaccine when it would not prevent transmission was just absolutely preposterous.
To say nothing of actually causing harm.
The big thing that I've been focused on, because it's the most discernible, is myocarditis in young people who never needed the vaccine, by and large, with the most rarest of potential infections at all. And it's a serious myocarditis that they develop, including and fatal cases.
Young people, including
young men, military, yes,
military age men.
Yes,
in,
yes.
Significant quantities. Andy, yeah, we have to have you back to talk about all of this at greater length. Sure. We look forward to doing so. Thank you for your insights into these three different, very important topics. We appreciate your time. Godspeed, my friend, and your good work. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again very shortly. Until then, go forth and multiply.